The Sunstone Theological Society presents the 1958 Apostasy in the French Mission, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has been sending missionaries all over the world for nearly 160 years, but few events have had a greater impact on the missionary work than the 1958 apostasy in the French mission. After that traumatic set of events, missionary oversight, interviews, and reporting have been standardized since that time. Though it has now been 30 years since the French mission apostasy, the repercussions are still being felt in the church at large, and particularly in the lives of the missionaries who were directly involved. This session is being sponsored by Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. The first paper, The Trial of the French Missionaries in 1958, will be presented by Kalil Mayer. Kalil is a professional librarian. He has 3 degrees, a BA in Russian, an MA in History, and a Master of Library Science from Brigham Young University. He has published in The Ensign, the Journal of Mormon History, Dialogue, and the Genealogical Journal. He is married and has 5 children. I asked him, he was not a missionary in this mission, but he was a personal acquaintance with someone and knows him very well, who was a missionary and became interested in that manner. Bob Bennett is a lawyer by training with a degree from UCLA, a law degree from UCLA, now lives in Boston, where he is president and chief executive officer of Mirror Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Times Mirror. And he is married and has 6 children and is a grandfather. He was a missionary in France during this time. And actually, he said that he had been there for 6 months at the time of the temple, of the London Temple dedication, and then served his other 2 years. The title of his paper will be In the Aftermath, the French Mission, 1958-60. And following these two papers, Dr. Derek Thom, another former French missionary, will respond to the papers. And he has a PhD in geography from Michigan State University and is currently department chairman of the geography department at Utah State University. He did serve in France during the trial and has returned many times since. He is married and has 3 daughters. He is a specialist in the French-speaking African countries. Following the presentations, they will be open for questions, and so we would like to entertain as many of those as we can. And because this is on tape, we would like you to please come down if you can to state your question. What should I say? Maybe you better. We'll repeat them. Thank you.
He was short, stocky, bull-necked. He gripped your hand, trembling with strength, cocked his head, looking you straight in the eye, and said, in an earnest, throaty voice touched with a whisper, "How are you, brother?" That was Elder William Tucker, missionary to France, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Elder Lofton Harvey thought this new acquaintance to be somewhat overdone and accepted the greeting askance. Later, he would come to respect and admire Tucker. Briefly, their paths would be joined before a church tribunal. Today, I'd like to tell the story of Lofton Harvey, French missionary. To do this, I need to tell the story of William Tucker and of the French mission apostasy. Harvey was but one of the many missionaries who knew Tucker. Early in 1958, Tucker became the second counselor in the French mission presidency. Tucker traveled the mission frequently, working with the missionaries alone and in small groups. He was in a position to know many and to be known by many. To mission leaders and missionaries alike, Tucker seemed to be the ideal leader for proselyting. He was well-read in church doctrine. On a personal level, he was quiet, soft-spoken, gentle, and confident. On a public level, he was dynamic, charismatic, a quick master of French, and a rigorous worker. Harold W. Lee, mission president at the time of Tucker's arrival, pointed him out to newly arrived missionary Marlene Wessel and said, "If you want to be a good missionary and baptize, watch Elder Tucker." Yet unseen dissonance belied an orthodox demeanor. Tucker harbored many unresolved questions about the church that were not being answered in a manner he desired. In France, he shared his conclusions with others, those he found to be receptive. Conducting a mission within a mission, he sifted through the elders, looking for his own harvest. Attracted to him as a paragon of missionaries, many encountered a Pandora's box of doubt. The matter culminated in September 1958. All French missionaries crossed the English Channel to attend the dedication of the level. The entire contingent was interviewed by church authorities to determine their allegiance. When confronted by the authorities, 9 were then excommunicated in a trial that was without precedent in the history of LDS missionary work. The 9 were not all Tucker's confederates. In particular, Lofton Harvey, never party to the lengthy doctrinal trysts with Tucker or his inner circle, still found himself sitting with the defendants on that September day in London. The formal lasted but a few minutes. The trial that followed for decades. Prospects for having a successful year in the French mission never seemed better than in 1958. Word throughout the mission was that the nighttime of the French mission was over. New hope and enthusiasm was matched with an upsurge in converts, presaging the possibility of more than 200 people accepting baptism within the year, twice the number than in any previous year since the organization of the mission. Many attributed this ebullient atmosphere to Tucker. He first began to attract mission-wide attention in Marseille by engaging in an intensive program of prayer, fasting, study, and visionary preaching. Attendance at church meetings and the number of convert baptisms rose dramatically. Less noticed was the fact that he carried his regimen to an extreme, studying the gospel 80% of the time and proselyting the other 20%. Transferred to Herstal, Belgium, Tucker reinvigorated the branch. His work was seen as setting the French mission on fire. His successes gave credence to his claim to be guided by revelation in his labors. In February 1958, he was called by mission president Milton Christensen, who had replaced Harold W. Lee as the mission president in the interim, to serve as his second counselor. An elder who went door-to-door with Tucker after his appointment as a counselor described the experience. His door approach was firm and respectful. Lessons were simple, clear, forceful, and adapted to the special needs of each individual contact. Yet, while trying to convert others, Tucker continued to question his own conversion. He had come to the conclusion that the church had erred in abolishing polygamy. Over time, he adopted other beliefs regarding the temple garment, priesthood authority, etc., more in line with the preaching of fundamental offshoots from the church rather than with the doctrine espoused by contemporary church authorities. Over time, Elder Tucker began to approach numerous missionaries to gauge their understanding and susceptibility to his beliefs. Carried by the force of his public performance, many elders were susceptible to his private precepts. He attracted various confederates. One of these was J. Bruce Wakeham. Wakeham was from Duarte, California, and a member of the Pasadena Stake, the same stake from which Tucker came. Wakeham was cut from the same mold as Tucker. Tucker effusively praised his colleague on one occasion, pointing to Wakeham and exclaiming, "Now, there is a prophet of God. A second adherent was Stephen Silver. Appointed as Tucker's companion after Tucker became a counselor, he absorbs Tucker's teachings on a daily basis. Tucker's teachings had a profound impact on Silver's personality. Previously fun-loving, cheerful, and energetic, he became somber, pious, and reticent. A third was the ethereal and elusive Daniel Jordan. Jordan was extreme in his attitudes and action. He refused to eat white bread or chocolate. He would pray in the out-of-doors, looking straight up in the air. He kept a pencil and pad by his bedside to record his dreams, which he considered revelations. Rather than proselyte, he mostly just studied. His abnormal behavior and aloofness were at times frightening to others. Tucker gathered these three elders to the Mission Center in Paris in March 1958, and for several months, all four continuously traveled the mission, proclaiming the gospel publicly and propounding their own set of beliefs privately. They would test the missionaries by stating an apostate principle. What they next taught would depend upon how the elder reacted. If the elder was confused and quizzical, they might pursue the topic to bring him around. If he rejected their principle and appeared to be knowledgeable, they would let it pass. Much of Tucker's influence was definitely for the good. He was a firm advocate of the word of wisdom. His hard work was emulated by others. His strong recommendation for spirituality in missionary work inspired many to greater exertion in their calling. Yet, those elders with whom he shared his private beliefs were confronted with issues they had not encountered, much less resolved, before their missions. Missionaries did not always realize that in considering the ideas of Tucker, they were courting apostasy. Born a sister missionary commented on the situation. I was just thrilled with my new knowledge. I'd write home and say these beautiful doors were being opened to me. I guess my letters must have sounded crazy. I really didn't think I would ever have to give up my beloved church. I didn't know I was headed in that direction. His influence was extensive. One estimate is that a third of the missionaries eventually came to be in sympathy with Tucker. Of these, a group of about 30 could be considered as firm believers. One of those who did not share his beliefs was Lofton Harvey. Arriving in Marseille after the departure of Tucker, he was soon confronted with Tucker's doctrines, though unknowingly at the time. He was the senior companion of J. Bruce Wakeham, one of Tucker's secret adherents, and not yet appointed as a traveling elder. There were two other elders, Bob Johnson and his junior companion, Wayne Cheney, and two sisters, Marilyn Lamborn and Wanda Scott. During a district testimony meeting, Elder Cheney testified of his belief in the Adam God theory. Johnson objected vehemently. Before the confrontation came to blows, as Harvey suspected it might, he took control of the situation, trading companions with Johnson until tempers settled. In the meantime, Johnson, an ardent admirer of Joseph Fielding Smith, wrote to him concerning the incident. Word eventually got back to President Christensen that something was amiss in Marseille. In April 1958, he sent Tucker to investigate. Tucker made several visits there in April and May, assuring the president that the situation was in hand and that the missionaries had been counseled not to study things that they could not understand. The president did not yet realize that the person assigned to resolve the problem was the source of it. Tucker functioned as a second counselor for 8 months before his hidden agenda began to come to light. In August 1958, two elders, Ronald Jarvis and Harvey Harper, disillusioned with their missions because of Tucker's teachings, decided to go home. On August 14, they divulged their feelings to President Christensen. The president tried to work through the problem with them, but the effort was unproductive. The next day, Elder Tucker was present, having just returned to Paris. Under the direct questioning of the president, Tucker's front began to collapse. President Christensen soon realized this was something bigger than he could handle alone. He telephoned the First Presidency. On Saturday, August 23rd, Apostle Hubie Brown arrived in Paris. Elder Brown was not able to undo in a weekend attitudes and decisions that had been building for months. He was unsuccessful in dissuading the disaffected elders from departing without permission from France. Tucker, who was in Lausanne when Elder Brown arrived, was immediately recalled to Paris. He arrived unheralded to a mission home filled with guests. Mary B. Firmage and Zina B. Hodson, along with Zola Brown and Lawrence Brown, all siblings of Elder Brown, had arrived at the French mission home on Sunday, August 24. They had been on an excursion in Europe and had received no notice of what was afoot in France. As they sat down to dinner, Mary remembers that a young man came in. Suddenly, she felt a terrible spirit. She and Zina looked at each other, and Zina whispered, "It's Satan," indicating that she shared Mary's feeling. When confronted by the apostle, Tucker came out in open opposition to church authorities. Elder Brown summarily released Tucker as counselor in the mission presidency. Lofton Harvey arrived in Nancy in late August 1958. He found the missionaries discussing the Adam God theory, conscientious objection, and the United Order. Harvey opposed the beliefs they were discussing, yet he made no connection between this incident and that in Marseille as being part of a larger scenario. Rumors raced through the ranks of the missionaries gathering to cross the channel and attend the London Temple dedicatory services. Missionaries learned that Jarvis and Harper had left and that Tucker had been removed from the mission presidency. They encountered rough seas and passage to the English coast. On Tuesday morning, September 9, all French missionaries were interviewed by general authorities prior to leaving for the temple services. A select group was called out first, being those most suspected of disharmony with the church. Harvey, to his surprise, was included in the first group of interviewees. A week earlier, while still in France, he had confessed to President Christensen that he did not honestly know that David O. McKay was a prophet of God. He admitted such not as a result of anything taught by Tucker, but as a true statement of his understanding. He did not anticipate the reaction that position would soon elicit. He entered the room and was confronted by Apostles Joseph Fielding Smith, Hubie Brown, and Henry D. Moyle. They came to the point quickly, Elder Smith asking simply, "Do you know that David O. McKay is a prophet of God?" Harvey had grown up in the church. He had accepted most of its teaching casually, with the exception that he had received a strong testimony concerning the Book of Mormon. But, he reflected within himself, could he honestly answer yes to the question posed? He simplified a sudden surge of emotions, desires, and questions with the response, "No, sir. I'm sorry, I don't." The authorities were equally unsuspecting, and according to Harvey, exclaimed, "I can't believe it. Disgraceful. Shocking." With that, Harvey was dismissed. He exited feeling a great sense of relief that the interview was over and assuring himself that he had been honest, even if he did not say that which he knew they expected him to say. William Turner, junior companion to Daniel Jordan, but a new missionary who was not suspected of collusion, was interviewed by a single church authority, L. Ray L. Christiansen. Turner had not prepared doctrinally for his mission, taking the gospel for granted and accepting a mission call in stride. He had accepted what Jordan had taught him without much question. He innocently responded to Christiansen's questions. Yes, he had heard that some current general authorities practiced polygamy. Yes, he thought you should not eat meat. Finally, Christiansen said that Turner believed in false doctrine and that he had better change or he would be excommunicated. Turner protested in a befuddled way. Christiansen looked him straight in the eye. Fortunately, he detected that Turner only needed help. He wrote a short note to President Christiansen and sent Turner to find him. Having delivered the note, Turner was directed to a room where he sat and waited, fearing he would be excommunicated. He watched missionaries who had passed their interviews go by, cheerful in their anticipation of the temple dedication to be held that day. It seemed to him that he had been engulfed by an abyss from which he might not escape. Nevertheless, he was granted permission to attend the temple dedication and eventually came to terms with the experience. Bruce Cummings was in sympathy with Tucker's teachings, but his interview before a general authority in London changed his perspective. It had been easy to be persuaded by Tucker's personality and logic. However, he recognized a difference when listening carefully, eye to eye, with an authority, paying attention as to whether the communication was spiritual as well as temporal. For Cummings, the interview was decidedly beneficial as he recanted from the thoughts of the previous few months. 10 missionaries did not pass the interviews, including William Tucker, J. Bruce Wakeham, Stephen Silver, Daniel Jordan, Neil Polson, Lofton Harvey, Marilyn Lamborn, Janae Abbott, Nancy Folk, and Marlene Wessel. Harvey, feeling deeply the rebuff of the general authorities, began to see himself somewhat romantically as an apostate, not from any affiliation with Tucker, but because he had spoken out that he did not know. When many whom he suspected as being of the same disposition had said yes for fear of being different and socially rejected, he began to revel in the shock he gave elders when he informed them of his status. The next morning, Wednesday, September 10th, the 10 missionaries, were called into a meeting with various authorities present. Elder Moyle took the lead, asking the group one last time to come to their senses. He offered them clemency if they recanted. Elder Moyle attempted various lines of argument, saying that if they had a testimony of one principle of the gospel, it was a testimony of the whole. That if Joseph Smith was a prophet, it proceeded that David O. McKay was a prophet. He suggested that they ought to listen to age and experience and to desist in being rebellious youth. President Christiansen and his wife both spoke to the group, bearing their testimonies and begging them to change. He said they could stay on their missions, even if they no longer did any proselyting. Sister Wessel, who was more confused than defiant, left the dissidents, reducing their number to 9. The meeting was adjourned for a second round of individual interviews. Harvey met with Elders Moyle and Christiansen and a member of the church's presiding bishopric, Thorpe B. Isaacson. The stress of unprecedented circumstances contributed to dispelling patience and understanding. The interview proceeded, in Harvey's opinion, more like an interrogation. He felt he was not able to say more than yes or no without being cut short. Harvey perceived Bishop Isaacson's arguments as browbeating. On the other hand, he was touched, but not persuaded by President Christiansen's pleadings for him to repent. Harvey arose to leave, and before departing, embraced President Christiansen. The strain of the moment suddenly burst as both men cried effusively. Harvey left the room and waited alone. Harvey now began to see excommunication as a reality. He still desired a testimony. He queried President Moyle during a break, asking as if he knew that David O. McKay was a prophet. While he was expecting a statement that would overpower him, Moyle simply responded, "Yes." Harvey remained unaffected. He chose rather to identify with his fellow defendants. He found comfort and companionship with them, though he did not yet share their doctrinal perceptions. Headstrong and swelling with youthful ardor, he began to accept the fact that he would have to be excommunicated because he did not know. Concurrent with the proceedings of the ten, the other French missionaries were attending a day-long testimony meeting at a local chapel. The group was first addressed by Hubie Brown, and at 10 o'clock, the meeting proceeded with each individual missionary standing to testify. During a noon break, four elders were asked by Elder Brown to go to the mission home. H. Ray Hart, one of the four, was not aware that they would serve as members of an excommunication court. While the elders were in transit, a second general meeting of the still disaffected missionaries was held. Bishop Isaacson spoke first. He lambasted the group for secretly promulgating their beliefs. President Christensen addressed the group with his most ardent appeal. Stephen Silver was one of the dissidents, saw only an excited man shouting at them. Elder Hart, entering the mission home at the same time, said he recognized the voice of President Christensen, but that it was a powerful voice, as if the Lord was speaking through him. The court was convened. As president of the court, Elder Moyle posed two questions. Do you sustain David O. McKay as a prophet, seer, and revelator of God? And two, do you want to be excommunicated? Each participant responded individually. They all answered the first question negatively and the second question positively. Tucker and Silver argued with Elder Brown, but with little results. Harvey did not argue. He remembers his comments being that he would like to know the truth and have someone help him. Further, that he felt no one would answer his questions, and that presently he really did not seem to have a choice, and that they probably ought to excommunicate him. Noting his ambivalence, President Moyle invited Harvey to be separated from the group and have his case reviewed individually. Harvey declined. He had finally cast his lot. The court lasted for several hours. The verdict was pronounced at 4 p.m. All nine excommunicated. President Christensen wrote later, "It was truly one of the most heart-rending things to ever come into my life to see our brothers and sisters excommunicated from the church for apostasy." The church authorities returned to the other French missionaries still in session. In what one missionary termed a phenomenally dramatic moment, the excommunication was announced. Elder Brown concluded the meeting at 8 o'clock in the evening with a discourse on the powers of the adversary and the future of the French mission. He described what had happened as the worst missionary apostasy in the history of the church. He further confided that the possibility of closing the mission had been discussed, but that the temple dedication had provided the opportunity to cleanse the mission. Now, Brother Bennett will address in a moment what happened in the mission after the excommunication. I would like to address the subject of what happened to Elder Lofton Harvey in the minutes left to me. Those who had been excommunicated returned to France to gather up their possessions before returning to Paris and departing for the United States. Left by their church to their own devices to get home, they pooled their money to obtain ship's passage. Suddenly, Harvey received word that news of his excommunication had been followed by a tragedy at his home in Utah. The bishop in his ward had addressed the congregation. Mortified by the excommunication, the bishop asserted that Harvey would never be rebaptized as long as he was bishop. Whether as a result of the news from France, the public announcement in the ward, or merely a coincidence, Harvey's father had a heart attack. Desperate to get home, Harvey obtained a loan from his girlfriend in Utah to pay for his airfare. He returned separately from the others to find that the heart attack had fortunately not been fatal. While Harvey had left the formal trial in London, the real trial had only begun. It was not easy for him to be at home. He suffered from the ostracism attended to excommunication at that period. His parents told him that he was influenced by an evil spirit. Harvey decided to move to San Francisco and discover whatever truth he could find alone. He went to Pentecostal, Catholic, and Jewish meetings looking for something and did not find it. He wrote to President McKay. The president responded that Harvey ought to do the Lord's will, leaving it up to him to make his own decision. He received no answer to his fasts and prayers and eventually gave up trying to know. In this frame of mind, he was approached in 1960 by two young men who were easily recognizable as LDS missionaries. Not knowing his background, they persisted in contacting him until he consented to receive lessons. He did not reveal his identity. But after a few lessons, the senior companion, Andrew Loudy, sensing that their contact knew more than he was revealing, stopped the discussion and asked, "Brother Harvey, were you ever a missionary?" Harvey said, "Yes." With tears in his eyes, Elder Loudy rose and embraced his investigator with a bear hug. The effect was as spiritual as it was physical. Harvey feeling something he had not felt for years. It was the turning point. Rebaptized in October 1961, Harvey requested to receive the priesthood in the summer of the following year. Elder Brown arranged an interview with Apostle Smith during July 1962. After some conversation, Elder Smith asked, "Do you know that David O. McKay is a prophet of God?" The same question Harvey had confronted under much different circumstances almost 4 years earlier. Harvey said, "Yes." Apostle Smith arose without further conversation, circled to the back of his chair, laid his hands on Harvey's head, and conferred the priesthood. Facing the opposition of those without the church is the common fate of missionaries. Facing the opposition from within their own ranks was the uncommon fate of the French missionaries of 1958. Uncommon circumstances convulsed to fling individuals into paths centrifugal to that proclaimed by their faith. For Lofton Harvey, the hope to know was not fulfilled until after he was publicly branded as being among the faithless. The apostasy in France was without precedent in the history of LDS missionary work. Church authorities failed to staunch the apostasy, though they succeeded in paring down the size of it. Yet the winnowing process may not have been foolproof, and in the case of Lofton Harvey, may have failed to distinguish between honesty and apostasy. Thank you.
I'm pleased to be here today. My thanks to the Petersons for inviting me. When the invitation first came 6-8 weeks ago, my first reaction was no. That's too far to go. 30 years ago, my memories dimmed. But then a thought occurred in my mind, and I reached up and I pulled an old missionary journal, dusty, off the shelf. And I sat at my desk and I read it for about an hour. I thumbed my way through it. And I then concluded that yes, I should, and I would come. Last night, as I flew here from Boston, I read this journal from cover to cover, perhaps for the first time. Completely absorbed in it. This is the only journal, I must confess, that I've ever written. And for some reason, with few exceptions, I recorded every single day. From February of 1958 until I left the mission field in September of 1960. Now, it was written by a young man 21, 22, 23 years of age. And as I read it last night, it's really not history. I'd sure be upset if someone 100 years from now found my journal and took it for history, or for the truth of all the matters that are said. It's a macro picture of what I felt, what I perceived, the reactions I had at that particular time. I was also delighted to see on the program that Derek Tom would be here. Derek Tom and I were two of four missionaries who left Salt Lake at the same time for France. In those days, you took a train across country, took the ship to Le Havre and the boat train into Paris, and we were there for the entire time together, although always in different parts of the mission. What I'm about to tell you, these are my perceptions and my reactions. There were approximately 120 missionaries in the field at that time, and each one would have his or her own perceptions and reactions. These are simply mine. I was never a companion to any of the missionaries who were removed from the church in London. I did not know them personally. I had met all of them, as a missionary would, a new missionary going to district conferences or missionary conferences, youth conferences, whatever. In fact, I didn't meet Frere Tucker until I'd been in the mission field 4 months. And I probably spent the most time with him of the nine. Arrived in the mission field in early April. In the mission home, met President and Sister Christensen, did not meet Frere Tucker because he was on the road somewhere. And immediately the next morning, I was on a train to Geneva in the Swiss district. Almost immediately, I heard talk of Frere Tucker. Much talk amongst the missionaries. Not a whole lot amongst the members. Some, but mainly amongst the missionaries. I never knew if what I heard was true. I don't know today if it's true. But these are the things that I heard repeatedly. And it's interesting, Brother Mayer. I have not read Brother Mayer's paper. Like you, I heard it this morning for the first time. It was said that he was a convert to the church, that he was a gifted speaker. The stories were that members would travel great distances to missionary conferences, not to hear President Christensen, but to hear Frere Tucker. He was a valedictorian at UCLA before he came into the mission field, spoke French like a Frenchman, knew the scriptures inside and out. He was portrayed as the ideal missionary. It was always, Frere Tucker said this, Frere Tucker said that, he did this, he did that. He was the example portrayed to all missionaries in the field. I remember very well my feelings at the time. Remember, I've never met Frere Tucker. but I was somewhat skeptical. I said to myself, I did not record it, and I did not say it to others. Oh, come on. I mean, this guy is just too good to be true. Those were the thoughts that were in my head. And so I was disposed not to like him. And there was talk, fundamentalist talk. For example, I remember having lunch one day with the district missionaries. This was in the Liège district. And I ordered a ham dish. I remember the reaction, because I was quickly... My attention was turned to Brigham Young's Discourses. Brigham Young's Discourses was a book that was quoted often in those days, wherein Brigham Young said that he knew as well as Moses knew, without putting it in a code of commandments, that swine's flesh was not to be eaten by man. And there were missionaries who did not. Well, I was transferred after 3 months in Geneva to Serang, from the celestial kingdom of the French mission to what many considered purgatory. Serang, Belgium, in the Liège district in eastern Belgium. Brother Mayer said that Brother Frere Tucker had been in Herstal. There were three branches, Herstal, Liège, and Serang in the Liège district. I was the junior companion of Bruce Cummings, whom you referred. There was much more talk in Liège about Frere Tucker and points of doctrine than had ever been the case in the Swiss district. Serang, we had the visit of Frere Tucker and his companion, Frere Hart. They dropped in to spend a day working with us. May I read from that day's entry? This is the 12th of August, that's just exactly 30 years ago. A very interesting day today. Frere Tucker and Frere Hart arrived this morning and we held a meeting. They told us of the happenings and spirit existing in the mission at the present time and instructed us in a new lesson plan, a six-in-one plan. At first I was rather dubious about it, but after seeing it at work later in the afternoon, I believe it is an improvement in a way. It doesn't sound like I was still hedging. Worked the first part of the afternoon with Frere Hart and the shorter remainder with Frere Tucker. It was very interesting talking with Frere Tucker and watching him work. I have a deep feeling of respect towards him. This evening after we came in, and after dinner, we started delving into the so-called, and I put in quotes, mysteries. The time passed by so fast, I hardly could believe it was 2 a.m. when we stopped. A great deal of unrest and uneasiness has been stirred up within me from this talk. I'm going to make the matter a matter of prayer. The Lord, I am sure, will help me to come to an understanding of what I'm to do. The next morning, we had breakfast with Frere Tucker and Frere Hart, and they left for the next city. And I remember a conversation that I had with Frere Cummings, my senior companion. I told him how disturbed I was. I didn't see how, I just didn't have the spirit to go out and knock on doors and preach the gospel. And that I was thinking seriously that we should go to Paris and talk to the mission president. Well, Frere Cummings suggested to me that since we were having a district conference in Brussels 3 weeks hence, that I could take care of it then. And I agreed. I'll never forget 2 points in the discussion that night, that early morning. I remember distinctly Frere Tucker turning the pages of his Doctrine and Covenants. From section to section, thus saith the Lord. Verily, thus saith the Lord. Thus saith the Lord. Verily, verily, thus saith the Lord. To whomever it may concern. The gist of his message was that either the church was in apostasy or the general authorities were living in secret plural marriage. He didn't say which. It had to be one or the other. Now, he didn't reveal those things to me. I'm sure all of that was addressed more to my senior companion, Brother Cummings. I just happened to be the junior companion there. Well, 3 weeks later, we had this conference in Brussels. May I read just a few extracts from that? Saturday, August the 30th. I have learned one of the greatest lessons of my life today. Arrived in Brussels and the first session of the District Missionary Conference just in time to hear the last half of Brother Ellsworth's talk. Then we had the privilege of hearing from Apostle Moyle. Henry D. Moyle was then the second counselor in the first presidency, as I recall. He really snapped us all to our senses. He completely denounced the spirit that has been going on in the mission with regards to fundamentalism and the reading of books that take away from our proselyting time. After he finished, we went down to the center of town, this is in Brussels, and held a street meeting for a couple of hours. After the street meeting, we returned for the second session of the conference. First, Sister Christensen spoke to us. And then I was hit hard. President Christensen gave one of the most inspired talks I've ever heard. He almost shed tears when he told us two of our missionaries were on their way home, having denounced their testimony and the authorities of the church. One of them was Elder Jarvis, a very good friend of mine at Brigham Young. I was very shocked and heartbroken, as was everyone else. He then answered every question that had risen in my mind the past months. He completely denounced the mystery and fundamentalist spirit that existed in the mission and said that our faith and prayers were needed to help those that were in this fold that they might be able to stay and finish their missions. After this session, we had an evening event. And while it was going on, we stayed outside and discussed the things we had heard during the day. Fair Cummings, Wood, Weston Scow, and myself were engaged in such a discussion when Apostle Moyle came outside and walked over to us. We took the opportunity to ask some questions that were bothering us, and we then heard our questions answered in a testimony that shook us. Up early this morning and headed for priesthood meeting, Apostle Moyle spoke in both sessions of conference, and everyone sat on the edge of their chairs and listened to every word. In all our spare time, we discussed the events of the past 2 days and the seriousness of the situation. At the last session of conference, President Christian called a special meeting for all the missionaries. He wanted us all to stand and bear our testimonies and state whether or not we sustained the general authorities. Well, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 weeks, not even a week, 10 days later, the London Temple dedication took place. Tuesday, the 9th of September, 1958. At 6 a.m. this morning, we were in London. All the missionaries met in the British Mission Home, and we were all separately interviewed by 8 of the general authorities. I was interviewed by Gordon B. Hinckley. And I told him about discussions I had participated in regarding polygamy. I did sustain the authorities and as a result received an invitation to the temple dedication. The sad thing is that several of our brethren and sisters were unable to sustain the authorities and didn't get to the temple services. Sister Wessel was one from our district, and we all felt heartbroken. It looks like all our trouble in the mission is coming to a head. The temple was beautiful, and we stayed for both services. The first session was for the French mission, and every word was directed at us. It was wonderful to hear the prophet speak again. The missionary conference was supposed to begin after the dedication, but was called off until early tomorrow. The next day, Wednesday, the 10th, the missionary conference started early this morning and was directed by Apostle Brown. It was marvelous the way he helped us all, put us all at ease, and prepared us for bearing our testimonies. All morning long, testimonies were born until Apostle Brown was called away, and then we all went for lunch. During the conference session in the afternoon, everyone else bore their testimonies until long after dark. After all testimonies had been born, Sister and President Christensen talked, followed by Brother Isaacson, and then by Apostle Brown. Apostle Brown then told us what had been happening during the day with our brothers and sisters, missionaries who weren't with us. I didn't really know how to refer to them. They had been pleaded with and interviewed to no avail, and in the end had all requested and were excommunicated from the church. There were nine, and then I list the nine. There were a couple of others on the borderline, and we're sure praying for them. Next morning we're leaving. We're going to the train station. This morning on our way to the GAR, the train station, we ran into the group that were no longer a part of us, is the way I put it. And it was heart-sickening to see them and their happiness in the thing they had done. I didn't remember that until I read that again. What I remember is standing at the wrought iron gate between the inner sanctum of the station and the outer, and they were on the outer and we were on the inner side, and they were bearing testimony to us and we were bearing testimony to them. Well, we left. It was a long journey back to France, very quiet, sullen. But that didn't last long. We were involved in typical missionary work immediately. The next day I was transferred out of Liège district. Found myself in Brussels for another 5 months. And as I read through the day-by-day accounts, what had happened in London was not a focus of attention. It just was not. We were concentrating on the reason we were there. Now, I'm sure that there were some missionaries, those who had been out much longer, who had had more of an association with those who had been cut off from the church, who really had a hard time building their spirits up, and many of them just filled out their time and left. But that was clearly at a minimum. We were doing missionary work. Well, in July of 59, some 10 months after London, I was called as a traveling elder. In those days, we had two pairs of traveling elders and the second counselor and his companion who continually crisscrossed the mission, working with the missionaries, spending anywhere from 1, 2, 3 days with each set of missionaries. And until I left the mission field in September of 60, I functioned in that kind of capacity, either as a traveling elder or as a second counselor in the mission presidency. And so I had an opportunity constantly over that period of time to visit with every pair of missionaries, work with them, talk to them, teach them, meet with and talk to members. And I tell you, from my perception, from where I was, the events at London were not on our mind. We were doing missionary work. In December of 59, some 15 months after London, President Christensen was released, and President Edgar B. Brossard, who was then serving as the mission president in New England, came to France. It was his third mission to France. And President Moyle was there. And he called and set apart the new mission presidency. Elder Owens, Wayne Owens, Congressman Owens, was his first counselor, and I was his second. And we were set apart by President Moyle. I have that blessing today. Had a lot of blessings, but I never had a blessing quite like that. Well, President Moyle gave three talks in over 3 days in mid-December of 1959 at the time this took place. In the first, he spoke to the presiding elders from all over the mission field. The second, he spoke to all of the missionaries in the Paris district. And in the third, he spoke to all of the members in the Paris district. I found a copy of the three talks. They're just a couple of extracts. Brethren, just as sure as we live, the time has arrived for the conversion of these people. The door is open a little wider. They are just a little more receptive. And the events politically and otherwise that have recently happened support this. He was talking then politically about the extent the French government should support the Catholic private schools, and there was much debate, and it appeared that we were breaking away from that. Everything that occurs over here from now on is going to open the door wider and turn the hearts of righteous people toward the truth and away from superstition, ignorance, and error. The second charge that I want to leave with you tonight, and that is that your baptisms for 1960 should double the baptisms for 1959. At least that ought to be the minimum. There isn't any more doubt. 400 then is the minimum. I love to see men with greater faith than I have. 400 is a proper objective. We had 259, and that was the largest number ever in the history of the mission. French mission had averaged one baptism per missionary per year. And so 400 was set by President Moyle. Well, shortly after that, President Alvin R. Dyer was named as president of the European Mission, and the European Mission was opened again. And on March the 1st, 1960, while I was traveling and working in Marseille, I got a telegram in the evening that President Dyer and President Christensen wanted me in Brussels the next morning for breakfast. He had called all the presiding elders from all of France and all of the Dutch mission together in Brussels, Belgium. I'll never forget that trip. All night, arriving at 6 in the morning, and then having breakfast and spending the day with President Dyer. It was a day of indescribable. It was a day where we left, when we left that meeting at the end of the day, we knew what we were going to do. There wasn't any question in our mind. We knew what was ahead of us and what were we going to do. And he challenged us to really become missionaries. And on, after talking to each of the presiding elders, challenged us to have 100 baptisms in the month of March. And this was the 1st of March. We went back into the field, and at the end of the month, we had 111 baptisms that month. Then on the 7th of May, President Dyer called us again into Paris, all of the presiding elders of the French mission. He doubled our missionary goal from 400 to 800. And he challenged us to have 400 baptisms by the 4th of July. And on July 4th, we had 403. I can't even begin to describe for you the electrifying spirit of 1960 in the French mission. Almost without exception, every missionary was involved. There was such a spirit. We could do anything. We had faith. I have never had such faith in my life. I have never experienced the spirit as strong as I did in that year, 1960. So what happened? The church had the greatest growth in its history to that time. In the 2 years following London. Now, I left the church 10 years later, and I left the church for 10 years. And I'm fairly certain in my mind that I might have made it much longer than 10 years. But I could not forget 1960. I could not forget what I had felt, what I had experienced, No matter how much I tried to put it behind me, I could not. And so when I think of the French mission 1958-1960, what I remember is 1960. Oh, yes, I can't help but also remember 1958. But that wasn't the mission. It was what happened in 1960. Thank you.
Just before I begin, I'd like to have a show of hands of how many are former French missionaries that were there during this period. Could I have, during this period, just from 57 to 1960? Okay, I see Lofton Harvey is here, so I want to make my... He's hiding from me. maybe we could ask Lofton if later to make some comments. I would like to just comment briefly. I can't believe it's been 30 years since these events took place. I had the opportunity to review Khalil's paper that he submitted to Dialogue several months ago, and it was just like yesterday that these events took place. I want to congratulate Khalil for his excellent research that he's done on this. As I read through his paper, which is published in the most recent issue of the Dialogue, which I guess went out on Wednesday, and I would recommend it to all of you who are interested in this topic. I didn't think apostasy had such great appeal, but the crowd here seems to indicate it. I think the research that has been done on this topic, we were given a kind of a directive in 1958 by Hubie Brown not to talk too much about the events of London. To go back and essentially do your missionary work, do the job you were called to do, proselytize, and so forth. So I think over the years, through the old Return Missionary Network, a lot of perhaps misconceptions developed about this whole issue. And I'm glad that it's finally coming to light. I think with the perspective of 30 years... it has put it in a very different perspective than really having lived through it. There are a number of questions that I raised in the longer paper. I guess this was just a shortened version of what you presented. Of course, the key to the whole apostasy was this man Tucker. Unlike Bob in mentioning that he did not meet Tucker until three or four months, I met him the day after Bob left. I stayed in the mission home for a few extra days, and he came back from his trip, and I was immediately captured by the man. There was an aura about him that was just very appealing. And, of course, he was held up, as has been expressed, as the model of what a good missionary should be. And so I was assigned, my first assignment was to the city of Toulon. And it was a city that had just been reopened. There were no members of the church at that time. And my companion and I were really the only two members in the city. But if you know your geography... Toulon is located between Marseille and Nice. And most of those who were involved in this apostasy had been in one of these two cities. And so when Frère Tucker was made second counselor and had appointed some of his, disciples, if you will, to positions of traveling elder and so forth. There was a lot of activity in the Nice district, and these missionaries were going back and forth between Marseille and Nice, and in Toulon I had the opportunity of meeting virtually all of these people who were involved in this. And I guess my companion and I were not ready for it. That's the only conclusion I can come to, because I was impressed with Tucker. I read through my journal last night, like Bob did, and I found that the first visit that Tucker had, I have a glowing report on the man. And especially was I impressed about his knowledge of the Doctrine and Covenants, his ability to quote by heart passages in the Doctrine and Covenants. Dan Jordan, one of the few missionaries that I met that I had a very negative impression about. I did mention that I thought he was a fanatic. We went tracting with him, and it's the most horrible experience that I've ever had in my life. I was raised in Great Britain, and as a youngster of 15 or 16, I had contact with the missionaries and would go out tracting, and it was always quite an enjoyable experience. My experience, however, with Dan Jordan, when he saw the door was closing, he immediately would stick his foot in there and call the people to repentance. My French was minimal, but I knew he was not saying the right thing. And when finally the door would be closed, he would turn around and he'd shake his feet as though shaking the dust from his, and he'd turn to me and he would say, "Well, they've had their chance." And I remember just praying, hoping that the next door we knocked on, no one would answer. I don't think I've ever had that experience before. His companion was Bruce Wakeham. I found Bruce to be a very delightful person. I enjoyed tracting with him. Well, so much for my reminiscing. Tucker, there are a number of questions that I don't think were really answered in the paper. I know that the paper is really not about Tucker. It would be nice to see an expose on the man, to do future research on Tucker, because he was a fascinating individual. You couldn't help but like him. What is not perhaps brought out in the paper are some of the questions that I have raised. First of all, how old was Tucker? My impression was that he was older than the rest of us. We were mostly 20, 21-year-olds. I believe he was a graduate. Bob mentioned something about him being a valedictorian at UCLA. Is that the truth? Or is that folklore? Is this part of the aura of the man? I even had a notation in my journal that he spoke Hebrew. Now, where I got that from, I don't know. Like Bob says, something about your missionary journal being history and searching for the truth. I think what we need to do is really analyze this man. But I do recall him as being a very dynamic individual. I don't think he was a tractor, though. I never heard anything about him going tracting and doing the things that missionaries do. It was always the cerebral thing that he was involved in and seemed to be most adept at. Some of the other things about the death of Bill Tucker. There was a folklore I recall very vividly in the late 60s, meeting Jeff Butler, who was a former missionary in France, an Australian. I met him in Salt Lake Airport, and he said, "Have you heard? Bill Tucker's dead." And I said, "No, I hadn't heard this." And he said, "Well," he died of acute appendicitis. Refused to have his aid. He was going to be cured by by laying on of hands, and he refused to have medical attention. And then it was also mentioned that he was still an apostle in the Church of the Firstborn. Now, what is brought out in Kalau's paper is that he died an atheist. Now, I have to question this. Having known the man, the certain appearance of spirituality that he had. Is this just wishful thinking on the part of the church? Did he really die an atheist? I think you've convinced me that probably your proof is much better than mine. Mine is the old Return Missionary Network, and I guess that is not too reliable. Again, I would like to. I think these sort of things need to be clarified. The period of Reconstruction, if I can call it that, Bob referred to. My impression of this period was quite different. For me to go back to France after London, incidentally, for me to go to London, I thought this was a great opportunity. I'd looked forward to the day of a temple being built in London, and I thought, well, here I am on the mission. The French mission is not part of the British temple area. I guess I'm not going to get to go. And then when it was announced that we go, I thought that was great. But as we went from Toulon up to Paris, and as missionaries got on the same train, talk began to circulate. Well, we're not going to the London Temple dedication because we're good missionaries. We're going there because we're bad. And they want to sort this out. And it was incredible. The other thing that I mentioned, referring back to when I mentioned that I wasn't ready, and my companion was not ready for this these latest revelations from the group. I remember, as I look back, there are subtle things that as we held meetings with Tucker and Silver and Jordan and Wakeham and even Marilyn Lamborn and Juna Abbott and others as they passed through. As I reflected back after London, that they were actually feeling their way, and I think they wrote us off. One of the things that was suggested, and this was suggested by Tucker, was that we had a tract, the Joseph Smith tract, the Joseph Smith story, and on the back page was a list of quotes from general authorities and so on and so forth. Now, the suggestion was, well, why don't we just tear this page off? Now, the people don't need the proof. They want the Joseph Smith story pure and simple. And my reaction, you know, here you tear off a piece, and where the staple is, you leave a little piece so it doesn't fall apart. And I says, well, gee, that looks kind of messy. And I think with a statement like that, they just gave up. And we didn't tear off the proof on the back. Some of the other things getting back to this reconstruction, the city of Toulon was closed after the mission. I think that's one of the things that kind of put me in a depression. I was just getting to enjoy Toulon, just having some success with the French language and so forth, and I was transferred then to Montpellier. And like Montpellier, first time I'd been in a branch, and all of a sudden I had trouble with the police. And so I got kicked out of Montpellier and was sent to Besançon to try to get things straightened out. And so for me, the aftermath of London did have its effect. And it did have an effect, I think, on some of the missionaries. That was one of the reasons that L. Rael Christiansen was probably sent over, and I think this is recounted in your larger version that is will be published in Dialogue. My recollection of the meeting with L. Rael Christiansen was totally negative. We held meetings, and he came in with a... I got the impression that it was like the good cop, bad cop type of a... first of all, send in the guy to really demolish. And this is what L. Chris Jansen did. He literally destroyed what I thought were some good missionaries. A former companion of mine who was just ready to go home. The 2 weeks prior to meeting with L. Chris Jansen, he had been sick. And I recall that he was asked to get up. He was the first one to get up in the group meeting in Geneva, in Switzerland. And L. Chris Jansen asked him, "What is your typical day? How does it go?" Well, he didn't quite know, wasn't quite sure what he wanted. And so he kind of hummed and hawed around. And finally, he had his previous 2 weeks' work in front of him. He said, "You didn't do much work the last 2 weeks, did you?" "No." He says, "Well," he says, "you're about to go home." He says, "Sit down. You have wasted 2.5 years. Now, that was a very harsh comment. And I had a very negative impression of that whole meeting. The next companion I had, next person he asked up was a companion that would have been an ideal. I hope he's not here. He would have been an ideal college roommate. Rarely got up before 9 o'clock. I've always been an early riser, so getting up at 6 o'clock was no trouble for me. And I would sit and study, and then he blamed me as a junior companion for not getting him up and getting him on the ball. But this fellow is a delightful man, but he was the next one that was invited up by L. Chris Jansen. And I thought, oh my goodness. And somehow he had a way with words, and he said, "Thank you, brother," said, "that's the way I want it." And I couldn't believe it, what was happening. It was an exceptional... but shortly thereafter, of course, we had President Moyle came around, and he was a totally different... and it was at this point in time that the challenges came. And I think Bob did a good job in recording. I wish my journal read like yours. I read through some of the things that I have said, and it sounds rather trite. And I tend to hide it from my kids. My daughter came down last night and saw me reading. She says, "What's that?" And she says, "Your missionary, my missionary journal." She says, "Oh, you have one of those." I said, "Yes." But again, I think that there are... it was a really unique chapter in the history of the church. And, of course, the missionaries, I don't think, talked too much about it. The rumors started circulating. As soon as we got back, and when I was in Besançon, a letter arrived to a teenage member of the church, from another teenage member over in, I guess, from Limoges. And the mother of this young teenager brought the letter and said, "Can you tell me something about this?" Well, in this letter, there were about three apostles who had been excommunicated, along with Brother Tucker and all the rest. And it was just... you know, blown way out of, obviously it was not the truth. So we had to go in, and in only a few instances, I think, did it really affect the members of the church. It was primarily a missionary. Another thing, of course, that as time went by, there were certain accusations of immorality in this whole issue. As far as I know, that is far from the truth. It was purely doctrinal. Theological disagreements and so forth. I recall visiting with my brother-in-law in Bristol when I was heading over to Africa one time. He was on a mission, and I remember sitting in the back of the van, and he was driving, and there was a missionary next to him, and started talking about this whole episode This was in 1978, 10 years after the fact, and started talking about the French missionary apostasy. And he had all sorts of missionaries and sister missionaries living together and sleeping around, and I just let him go. I couldn't resist, because it was so preposterous what was actually being stated. And finally, my brother-in-law turned to me and says, "Is that true, Derek? Is this what really happened?" And of course, I was able to, at least from my perspective, set it straight. But I guess I have as much misinformation as the next person. So I want to congratulate Kalil for his excellent paper. It's excellent reading. One of the things I would like to see is to go beyond this, to do additional research on Tucker the Man and what has happened to the rest of them. I think this becomes a very... There are some things that are alluded, but the story, I think, of Lofton Harvey is very well done. In the, I guess...
Are you finished?
Yes. Thank you.
I believe Sister Peterson mentioned that church policies have changed since that period. It would be a difficult thing to document if it was directly as a result of this apostasy that we have more stringent rules by which missionary is conducted. But I share her feeling that it probably had some impact on that.
I can't say what rules changed, but I know that I was the second counselor 18 months later, and my president kept very close tabs on me. I didn't have freedom to just move people around as I decided.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.